It's a golden fall day in Scandia, Minnesota, a rural farming community on the banks of the St. Croix River. The fields are full of yellow corn, 6 feet tall and ready to be harvested. It's beautiful in that tidy Midwestern sort of way. But for a pair of beekeepers, this scene suggests something more sinister. To understand why, we'll journey into a state laboratory and explore a lineup of molecules. But first, we have to go back to a Friday afternoon in May.
My name is Pam Arnold. I am one of the managers here at Salt and Pepper Farm. I live here. I've been keeping bees for quite a few years, 13 years.
Pam and her friend Christy Allen have 5 hives each. The spot is ideal for bees, protected by trees, surrounded by flowering goldenrod and clover. But beyond the bounds of the property, it's corn, as far as you can see. On a spring afternoon, Pam was out in her own field chopping buckwheat when she saw a tractor across the road, ready to do the planting. She noticed the winds were blowing toward her property, and she started to get a bad feeling.
So I checked on the beehives within a few hours of the corn being planted, and at that point, there were piles of dead bees in front of each of our hives.
She had seen insects die after corn planting before, but this time was different. The effect on her bees was immediate, and it was, well, dramatic.
Thousands of dying bees, and then behaving oddly, on their backs, flailing their legs, spinning around, trying to clean off their bodies.
So Pam called Christy to tell her what was going on.
Because I had been through this, so I...
Back in 2013, one of Christy's hives got hit with a pesticide called fipronil, used to keep termites away from buildings. By the time she showed up, more than 20,000 bees were already dead. She lost the hive, and she never found out who did it. To Christy, this was not okay. She wanted a way to hold someone accountable, whoever had sprayed the fipronil. So she talked to legislators, she sat in on committee sessions, she lobbied. And 4 months later, there was a new law on the books. It did 2 things. It made Minnesota the only state in the country to compensate beekeepers if they lost a hive due to someone else's errant spraying. And it created a task force of scientists to investigate these acute pesticide kills. Like a police forensic unit, this team traces the chemical culprit back to its human source. They're the Minnesota Department of Agriculture's bee team.
My name is Jameson Scholler, and I'm an entomologist.
My name is Matt Jorgensen. I'm an agricultural investigator.
And I'm John Peckham. I'm the manager of our inspection enforcement section.
Christy and Pam called the bee team when they found their bees dying. This was on a Friday afternoon. The next Monday, these guys showed up to figure out what happened. And I should say at this point that the Department of Agriculture wouldn't provide me with specifics about Pam or Christy's cases, because they are both still open and under investigation. So any details about what happened next comes from the beekeepers.
3 people came representing the Department of Ag. Each had a slightly different specialty. They asked us some questions.
Have you been treating for varroa mites? What sorts of...
Basically, they want to rule out other possible suspects. To find out what happened, the investigators next gather clues. And bees. Live bees go into jars and onto ice, so any pesticides in their bodies stay preserved. Dead bees get measured by volume, giving a sense for the overall death toll. 1 cup equals about 1,000 bees, which is the number you need to qualify as an acute kill.
And that's a level that indicates a threshold of damage that the colony may or may not be able to bump back.
This is probably as good a place as any to talk about colony collapse disorder, or CCD. Most people know bees aren't doing very well and that CCD is largely to blame. But while scientists don't know exactly what causes it, some mix of disease, lack of food, pesticide exposure, parasites, they do know the symptoms. And they look very different from what Pam and Christy saw on that Friday in May. With colony collapse, the bees disappear suddenly. They all leave one day and they don't come back. Which is why when Christy and Pam saw piles of dead bees, they suspected a pesticide. But before the Department of Agriculture could determine a culprit, the sample had to be analyzed.
We're in the second floor pesticide lab.
This is Gary Horvath, the lab manager at the Minnesota Department of Agriculture in St. Paul. This is where Pam and Christy's bees came for chemical analysis.
My name is Yoko Johnson. I'm a supervisor for the environmental analysis unit.
In the lab, Yoko grinds up the bees and mixes them with some liquid and salt. Then they get spun around in a centrifuge to extract out any pesticides that might be present into a few drops of clearish liquid. And in this liquid is the answer to the question of what killed Pam and Christy's bees. Now we just need a gas chromatography mass spectrometry machine.
I'm gonna start this.
Yoko turns on a machine that kind of looks like a big white microwave. It starts heating up to 250 degrees. This turns the sample into a gas. A sticky coating on a coil inside the machine separates out all the chemicals in this gas, including any pesticides that might be present. Then, the machine breaks up the different chemicals and weighs them. Each one leaves behind a unique signature. In forensic metaphors, this is our smoking gun.
The mass spectral response, the way it fragments, is like a fingerprint of the chemical you're looking for.
And like running a set of prints against a criminal database, the offending chemical is lined up with the Department of Agriculture's molecular library.
This is the chromatogram.
Yoko points at a computer screen. The monitor shows a series of sharp peaks, some tall, some short.
These peaks represent each substance. If you click it, so you can visually see it matches.
So just like that, we can know exactly which chemical is to blame. For Christy and Pam, that chemical was a pesticide called clothianidin. In the U.S., it's sold under the name Poncho 600.
There's certain levels that the EPA considers toxic to bees, and ours was on the lower side, but can still impact them.
Clothianidin belongs to a class of pesticides known as neonicotinoids because of how chemically similar they are to nicotine. They're used in about 95% of U.S. corn and soy crops. Most often, they're incorporated in seed coatings to protect the seed from hungry insects while it's in the ground during the plant's early life. But researchers have found that the pesticide could come off as a dust and drift onto other plants, plants that bees like. This is how Christy and Pam believe their bees brought home the poison that would eventually kill them. Not all of Pam's bees died following the pesticide hit, but she says the ones that lived haven't been the same since.
These bees are not defensive, they're lackadaisical. They haven't put up any honey.
There's another hive, too, one that Pam was tending for a friend, providing it with pollen and sugar water. Those bees weren't out foraging on the day of the corn planting, so they actually serve as a kind of control. And that hive? It's doing very well. 3 months after the incident, there isn't yet any closure for either Christy or Pam. For now, their cases remain open. Pesticide investigators like Matt continue to dig through records, interview neighboring farmers, and look at weather logs. Since 2014, when the compensation law was passed, there have been 10 investigations, including Pam and Christie's. No one has yet been compensated. And while it might be poetic for Christy to be the first person to benefit from a law she helped write, she's not holding her breath.
The investigation may or may not be able to prove that I had an acute pesticide poisoning as defined by this compensation law. But it's not about the dollars, it's about the fact that this is the system that we're in. And there's been multiple days this summer where I just, like, I'm banging my head against a beehive and I'm like, why am I doing this? You know, because you can go into a hive and everything looks beautiful and normal, and then the next day it's like, what happened?
Whatever happens with Christy's investigation, it's already become an important data point for her as she tries to make sense of the losses. Lately, a picture has started to emerge. This year, her best hives were across the river in Wisconsin, where it's too hilly for industrial agriculture. The worst ones were in southern Minnesota, surrounded by corn. She admits it may not be strictly scientific, but it's information she'll use next year to try to give her bees their best shot at surviving. But for Pam, moving her bees isn't an option. This is their home. And it's her home, too.
The privilege of living in an environment where all of these things are visible to us is counterbalanced by this sort of growing awareness that we're watching it end. Because what's affecting our bees is affecting the birds, is affecting the water. How do we measure the systemic impact of these acute situations?
It's a good question, a complex one that we don't really understand just yet. Lab studies don't do a good job of replicating real life, and causation outside the lab is tricky to prove because it's so uncontrolled. But some answers are beginning to come out. In the summer of 2015, British scientists showed that honeybee die-offs were linked to neonicotinoid seed treatments, the same stuff that Christy and Pam suspect killed their bees. Now, similar studies are underway in the U.S. Bees pollinate 90% of the world's food crops, so if the pesticides we use really are killing them off, bees might not be the only species losing out. I'm Megan Multenny. This production is part of the STEM Story Project, distributed by PRX and made possible with funds from the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation.